This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks!
Welcome to Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, the oppression of racism, the COVID-19 pandemic, climate change. We face multiple existential crises on planet Earth. All affect our mental health. Climate depression is the subject of this talk by Dr. Jennifer Atkinson. Professor Atkinson teaches one of the first college classes on eco-grief and climate anxiety. Here, she addresses how climate change impacts our emotions. Her approach includes strategies for staying resilient in the long-term struggle to deal with the climate crisis. Dr. Jennifer Atkinson teaches at the University of Washington, Bothell. She also hosts Facing It, a podcast about love, loss, and the natural world. She presented this talk, Climate Depression, Confronting Eco-Anxiety in the Age of Crisis, on February 28th at Seattle's Pacific Science Center. The event was part of their Science in the City series.
I want to open with just a couple of questions to the audience. How many of you have laid awake at night feeling a sense of dread about the future of our planet? Let me see a show of hands. Okay, so most people in the room. Now, I want to ask you, raise your hand if you have ever cried, like shed actual physical tears and needed a tissue over some ecological or climate issue. Okay, so about half or so, a bit less, but of course we are still in Seattle here, so it's a good number. You know, I think it's interesting that if I had asked who has ever cried at the death of a loved one, a family member or a friend, everybody's hands would shoot up. Like, you would be ashamed if you hadn't wept in that scenario because people might think you're a sociopath. But people feel sheepish admitting that they, you know, have cried because of a loss of wildlife or forests or a damaged river. We kind of look around first to see if anybody else is going to put their hand up because it seems a little bit embarrassing. So why is it healthy and even in some cases socially expected for us to mourn the loss of other humans but somehow eccentric to openly grieve for non-human species or the natural world? So those are a couple of questions that we're going to explore in this talk. I'm going to put them on hold for a moment and come back to that because this is the part of the talk where any climate speaker is expected to rattle off a bunch of terrifying statistics reminding you how bad our ecological crisis is. I do like to use some comic relief in my presentations. My personal favorite source is The Onion, so I've inserted some of their headlines in my slides because this is really heavy stuff, and we need to remember to laugh when we can. So I was about to say, I usually skip the part with the scary statistics because I assume that anybody who comes to a talk like this, especially on a Friday night, doesn't really need to be beaten over the head. But I was also thinking the other day, I give these talks all the time. I teach classes that talk about climate change. And yet every time I see these figures, they still knock me off my feet. So I'm going to give like the 3-minute refresher here because even though most of us know these facts, I don't think we've really processed what those facts mean and all of the profound ways that they will reshape our lives in the coming years. Because if we had truly internalized this, we wouldn't be going about our daily lives acting like everything was normal. And that includes myself. So these figures are all from NASA and from Climate Central, which post data from NASA and NOAA. 18 of the 19 hottest years recorded have occurred since 2000. The five hottest years on record occurred during the past 5 years. Some of you probably saw the news just the other week that Antarctica hit the highest temperature ever recorded on the continent. It was 65 degrees. Ocean acidification has increased by 30% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution from carbon dioxide emissions. We're seeing dramatic wildlife impacts. Last year, the UN issued a report that 1 million species may be pushed to extinction in the next few years because of human pressures, and habitat loss and climate disruption are some of the top culprits. The Living Planet Index has also reported that just since the 1970s, populations of vertebrate wildlife declined by 60% on average worldwide. That's 60. The Arctic Ocean is expected to become essentially ice-free during the summer by the middle of this century. NASA satellite data show that the rate of ice loss in Antarctica has tripled in the last decade, and that will further accelerate global warming. I've actually heard some climate communication strategists say it would be better if we quit talking about the ice sheets, because for most people, the Arctic is a remote place that they have no connection with, and people who live inland may be less concerned about sea level rise. But I think people are intelligent enough to understand that everyone should care about this, because the ice at our poles acts as the air conditioning system for the entire planet. White surfaces reflect heat. When ice melts and becomes darker ocean water, the planet absorbs more sunlight. That melts more ice. That exposes more dark surface, absorbs more heat, right? So there's nothing remote or distant about that. Extreme weather, we're seeing this happen in live time. Scientists are predicting more frequent and more disastrous weather events like floods and hurricanes in coming years. We could go on and on. Fires raging across Australia and the Amazon, displaced communities, dying oceans choked with plastic, recent studies showing that flooding from sea level rise will happen more quickly and dramatically than previous models predicted. All of this attention to physical impacts is incredibly important, but exclusively focusing on external damage overlooks the landscape of damage that we carry inside of us. Living through an age defined by so much destruction of life is bound to mark us by invisible traumas. And this is the question I've been wrestling with in recent years. What kind of emotional and psychological toll are we experiencing from absorbing all of this heartbreaking loss, day after day, year after year? But one of the problems is we don't live in a culture that openly mourns those kinds of losses, and that makes it hard to fully process their personal impact or even recognize that they exist, because most of us don't even have a language to talk about this. This is starting to change. So in recent years, we've seen terms like climate anxiety, eco-grief, pre-traumatic stress. They've been creeping into our vocabulary. And I want to emphasize, it's not just tree huggers like me and climate activists who are adopting this language. The American Psychological Association put out a major report in 2017 documenting this mental health crisis. Climate psychology has become a new field as therapists are seeing more patients with eco-anxiety and depression. Support groups like the Good Grief Network have chapters that are springing up across the U.S. to help people cope. So I'm going to spend a few minutes giving an overview of who and what we're talking about when we use terms like climate anxiety, and then we'll look at some of the more philosophical dimensions of what eco-grief means in our age of crisis. So I'm going to give a snapshot of four different groups. We're going to look at students, scientists, frontline communities, and then everybody, which is the kind of unscientific category you get to use when you have a humanities background. The group that I know best are students. They're the reason that I got interested in this topic. As David mentioned, I've taught at the University of Washington for 11 years, and every year I've seen more and more despair among undergrads. So these are quotes from my students on the first day of a class that I taught a couple months ago. Students tell me they don't want to have kids when they grow up because they could live in an apocalyptic future. Some have trouble sleeping at night because their minds are playing scenarios of water wars or climate refugees and mass extinction. They feel anger towards the previous generation that handed them this mess and guilty for all the ways they've contributed themselves. There's also a deep sense of betrayal. So the generation before them knew about the science, going back at least 30 years when NASA scientist James Hansen testified before Congress to warn about climate threats. But we didn't act. And in fact, we did the opposite. Every year since then, CO2 emissions have gone up. And last year, they hit an all-time high, smashing the previous record, which was set just the year before. One of the most shocking figures I have ever come across is that half of all emissions from human industrial activity have come from the last 30 years. That is since the IPCC was reported and since Bill McKibben published The End of Nature, sounding the alarm on climate change, since Beyoncé and her pals formed the girl group Destiny's Child. Like, a single generation is responsible for that. So there's no wonder that young people feel so much anger and depression. And it's especially hard for young people who start off very idealistic and they come to their first day of college, they're going to save the world, and then they learn how vast and complex the problem is. Researchers like Stephen Running have mapped these responses onto the five classic stages of grief, and there are actually a lot of different models out there. The process isn't necessarily linear, so you'll kind of slide back and forth between them, and I'm sure everybody in this room has gone through some of these stages at some point. Denial, anger, depression. Initially, the one that I couldn't quite place was bargaining, until I realized this is probably the response we engage in the most. I've actually caught myself feeling virtuous for taking my reusable water container on a flight and very vocally refusing when any drinks they want to serve me in a plastic cup, until I remember, oh yeah, I'm on an airplane, right? So going back to students, they're the group that inspired me to create this seminar to help build the resilience that we're all going to need in this age of climate consequences. And I am going to share those tips at the end of my talk. The second group that I would highlight are scientists. Environmental scientists suffer some of the highest rates of eco-depression and despair, which is not surprising since they're simultaneously documenting the disappearance of these natural wonders up close, and the loss of their own life's work. Catherine Wilkinson is one of the senior writers of the book Drawdown. She once said, "There is no way for me not to have a broken heart on most days." This is another quote from the ecologist Phyllis Windle. "I have a friend and colleague who does research in Greenland, and she was there during the historic heat wave that smashed records in the Arctic this past summer. She came back from the trip literally in a state of shock, describing the ice melting away beneath them and rushing out to the sea in rivers. And then just last week, she was in national headlines for her research showing that polar bears are having fewer babies and becoming skinnier." This is her study. I mean, this is a person who loves animals dearly. You go to her house and there are rescued dogs and cats on every piece of furniture, and there are photos of the bears that she studies framed on the walls like they were family portraits. And yet documenting them starving is her day job. But at the same time, coping with this is really, really hard for scientists because their field so prioritizes objectivity and dispassionate discourse. So there's a kind of stigma around discussing subjective or emotional responses. So scientists have to worry about compromising their professional credibility by appearing hyper-emotional. Then the third category of impacted groups are all the frontline communities, communities on the front lines, for whom this crisis isn't just something that they're, you know, watching from a distance. They're living it every day. Even though the concept of climate grief is still fairly unfamiliar to most of us, if you have heard of it, it's likely in the context of some extreme weather event, which is where we see the most visible psychological and mental health impacts. There's an extensive body of research now, including that major study that I mentioned from the APA, linking climate disruption to chronic anxiety and depression, post-traumatic stress, substance abuse, suicide and suicidal thoughts, sleep disorders, and a lot more. Not surprisingly, poor and marginalized communities and communities of color are suffering the heaviest impacts and therefore the most dramatic emotional toll from climate assaults. These are communities that already have inadequate access to affordable shelter and healthcare, reliable emergency services, not to mention mental health care. So it's infinitely more challenging to recover from a climate disaster or displacement. Hurricane Katrina was one of the most extensively studied disasters to date, and the APA reports that in the aftermath, 1 in 6 people impacted met the diagnosis for PTSD, and suicide or suicidal thoughts more than doubled for displaced people in New Orleans. Then you can go to the opposite side of the world, where reports of a mental health crisis are coming out of Australia in the wake of recent bushfires. And just a decade earlier, Australia had suffered through the longest drought since Europeans settled the continent, which devastated farmers' crops and livelihoods. And studies of that disaster showed a spike in substance abuse and chronic depression and domestic violence among farmers. Or you head to the Arctic, where indigenous people are talking about how a warming climate is wiping out traditional hunting and cultural practices and keeping them from traveling to their ancestral sites because the landscape is melting away beneath them. Suicide has gone up there as well. People say that their cultural identity is being devastated. This quote is from an Inuit woman that I think captures that cultural and spiritual erasure. She says, "Inuit are people of the ice. If there is no more sea ice, how can we be people of the ice?" And in fact, all indigenous communities with cultural or identity-based roots in the natural world are at particularly high risk of experiencing trauma from environmental loss in their homelands. So questions of colonialism and racism are fundamental to this issue, especially when we consider that grief for environmental loss has already been an ongoing reality for Native communities of North America since the arrival of Europeans. Only recently have these impacts started to hit home and become a problem for relatively well-off white folks, so college professors like me or the grieving scientists that I mentioned. This is why Native scholars like Daniel Wildcat have problematized the discourse about climate catastrophes as being the new normal or the new abnormal. That language explicitly frames this crisis as if it were something new. But Leanne Simpson, who's an activist and scholar from the Anishinaabeg Nation, said, quote, "Indigenous people have witnessed continual ecosystem and species collapse since the early days of colonial occupation. We should be thinking of climate change as part of a much longer series of ecological catastrophes caused by colonialism and accumulation-based society." And I'm going to come back to that issue in a few minutes. Then the final group I'd highlight is everybody. So whether we're consciously aware of it or not, and often we're not, even if you've never fled a wildfire or lost your crops in a drought, everyone's daily life is changing in 1,000 subtle ways. We've all lived through these slow-moving changes like the loss of bees or songbirds in our backyards or dying trees along the road, fishing trips where you come back with less and less every year. These can add up to a really deep sense of loss. It's what philosopher Glenn Albrecht has named solastalgia. And he's playing on the concept of nostalgia, so a longing for a time or a place that you can't go back to. But solastalgia happens when you're still at home. So it's a trauma or helplessness of watching your surroundings become unfamiliar. And he technically defines this condition as a homesickness experienced without ever leaving home. I think this is a really powerful concept because it gives us a way to talk about the invisible aspects of environmental experience that are so fundamental to our identity and memory and sense of self. This is an area where I did a lot of research as a grad student and later wrote a book on it in relation to gardens, where people might have subtle but deeply meaningful nature experiences through everyday activity. And even in our age of screens, when more and more experience has become virtual, there are still powerful ways that we relate to the physical world through our bodies and our senses, whether it's the constant background sound of a river or frogs or crickets at night. It could be the way weather and temperature interact with your skin and determine what you wear, or whether you choose to sit outside at certain times of day. Familiar sights that are cues for where you are, the smell of the air and different seasons. Those sensory aspects are so integral to everyday experience that when they're lost, it shakes our sense of identity and place and even our connection to the past. Your personal memory becomes destabilized. And I want to emphasize that solastalgia is not just an affliction of well-to-do environmentalists who can't backcountry ski in their favorite spots anymore. In parts of coal country where poverty is immense, so West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, Southwestern Virginia, scientific studies are showing a direct link between mountaintop removal, where mining companies destroy the tops of mountains to get to the coal, and increased mental health problems. Even when researchers have adjusted for educational status or socioeconomic outcomes, anything basically that could potentially skew the results, rates of clinical depression have been significantly higher in areas with mountaintop removal mining than in coal mining areas in the very same regions. People are actually 1.5 times as likely to exhibit at least moderate depressive symptoms compared to residents in neighboring counties. I think this is one of those statistics that's really stunning and at the same time just totally makes sense, right? I mean, if you live your whole life with a view of a mountain and then it's decapitated, your horizon is completely transformed. And the quote on this slide is from a Virginia resident commenting on her depression after the surrounding landscape was demolished. She said, "You're not only being harmed physically, you're being harmed spiritually. That intimacy with the mountain is gone." So that's just an overview of eco-grief and anxiety and some of the different ways that it's experienced. For the rest of my talk, I want to dig in a little deeper and come back to that opening moment where some of us might have felt a little discomfort admitting that maybe we've cried over a dead bird, or alternately, you recognize that you would never do that, that grief doesn't extend to the non-human world, or it just feels stigmatized to express that. I want to think about why that matters. So as we pivot to some of those questions, though, I think it's important to consider how grief might actually be a valuable resource for us. So I'm going to read an excerpt from my upcoming podcast, Facing It, that takes up some of these questions. When I first launched my seminar on eco-anxiety, I was every bit as distressed as my students and looking for ways to extinguish my grief for all this suffering. But something unexpected happened along the way. I had always thought of grief as a bad thing, a dark state to avoid or overcome as quickly as possible. I thought that feeling grief was like succumbing to a preventable illness, or that once it took hold, I might fall into a bottomless hole of despair. But then it dawned on me that maybe we were seeking solutions to the wrong problem. We all wanted to fix the way we felt so we could go back to feeling happy. But grief isn't something to be fixed because it's not dysfunctional. It's a healthy and necessary process we have to undergo if we want to arrive at healing and wisdom. In fact, grief can be a tremendous source of wisdom as we move into an uncertain climate future. I know this may sound controversial in a moment when environmentalists are urging us to focus on hope, but the two are not mutually exclusive, and for many people, grief may be an even more powerful force for transformation. First, grief isn't just one of many options for accepting loss. Grief is the process of accepting loss. I get why many people working towards sustainability want to sidestep emotional issues and push the public straight into action. The situation is urgent, and dwelling on our feelings can seem like an extravagance as the fires close in. But the problem is when we try to jump straight to the final step without first processing the emotional toll of all this lost beauty and life, we're bypassing the very insights that motivate us to fight for our world in the first place. Ignoring ecological grief is like trying to rush through any great loss, a job, a home, someone you love, without pausing to acknowledge what you're leaving behind. In all those cases, we're not just losing something we once had. We're also losing the future that many of us had counted on. We can't act creatively and honestly in this new reality if we still believe we're living in the old one. And most of us are stuck in a pre-climate change fantasy realm, clinging to delusions that our world in coming years will still be the world we imagined growing up. Denial isn't just a description for people who reject the science. It describes university professors like me and scientists who devote their lives to studying climate change and activists fighting to keep things from getting worse. We understand the problem intellectually, but we don't live as though we do. We accept the facts, but we haven't felt our way through what those facts mean, how our lives, how all lives will be undone in some way. We're like the person who knows a loved one is dead, but hasn't let that reality penetrate to their core, where it will reorganize all the ways they relate to the past and future and determine all they will have to let go of. So I like to say that giving yourself over to grief is the difference between reciting a fact and knowing a truth. But even though all personal losses share this difficulty of accepting some hard new truth, not all grief is identical. Climate grief may be more complicated than other losses in a number of ways. For one, we can't find comfort in telling ourselves that what's happening is a necessary and inevitable part of the natural life cycle. Unlike the death of individuals, ecological assault is preventable. Another difference is that our climate assault doesn't happen a single time to a single person. It's an intergenerational legacy that will leave behind a diminished world to everyone who isn't yet born. And third, while our loved ones may die of an illness we played no part in creating, with environmental loss we feel complicit, which adds more layers of guilt and denial. In the face of so much complexity, even people who can openly grieve in other situations feel numb in response to climate disruption. Or they learn that staying detached feels safer. Students and colleagues of mine have told me that's how they protect themselves and keep moving forward in the face of setbacks. I've gone through those phases too. But if we numb our sense of sadness and pain, how can we still feel love and compassion as intensely as before? Our emotional life can't be compartmentalized like that. When we deaden one sense, we diminish all the others as well. And the result is an impoverished experience of the world we want to save. So again, that's a clip from the podcast I've been working on to explore this issue. The name is Facing It, and the first episode should be out in April. But in my work, I'm also trying to push beyond just reframing grief as something that's not bad, to also consider ways that it's actively good. And there are three reasons I'd make this claim. First is that grief arises from deep attachment and connection. So it is a sign of love for the world. You just aren't going to grieve for something that you don't love. Martine Prechtel once wrote that, quote, "Grief is praise because it is the natural way love honors what it misses." Grief can also be an affirmation of trans species empathy and a recognition that our identities and well-being are entwined with other lives, human and non-human. So we shouldn't think of grief and love as opposites, but actually as two sides to the same coin. Seattle artist Chris Jordan, whose work has been a major impact on my thinking, has written that when we try to be cheerful and suppress our grief for the world, we're also suppressing our love for it. He writes, "When we hold grief at a distance, our love becomes inaccessible. And when we embrace grief, we reconnect with the essential aspect of our being that has gone missing." The second way eco-grief acts as our ally is by breaking down boundaries that we've created between ourselves and other species, as well as other humans. So we usually think of mourning as a private experience, as a condition where we turn inward, away from the world, but it can also be a political act. In our culture, as we all know, there is a hierarchy of lives that matter and lives that don't. Some deaths receive elaborate mourning rituals and public tributes, while others are trivialized or ignored. Marginalized groups know how this absence of public grief dehumanizes them, which is why LGBTQ activists, people seeking justice for murdered Indigenous women, and Black Lives Matter use public protests and vigils to demand that those deaths aren't made invisible. And I'm drawing here on the work of theorist Judith Butler, who reminds us how, again, some lives are grievable and others are not. When we refuse to shield ourselves from this pain of other species' death, we take part in what scholars call resistant mourning, which consciously chooses to hold on to feelings of pain and grief to spur a sense of responsibility for the loss. And once we start asking those questions, they ramify out to all kinds of other structural exclusions from our circles of compassion and ethical consideration. Again, people of color, women, Indigenous groups. So the politics of grief intersect with questions of social justice on multiple levels. And that brings me to number three. Indigenous scholars argue that grief can be a valuable lens for deepening and expanding discussions around environmental racism and climate colonialism. One example I really like is from Ron Reed, who's a traditional Karuk fisherman and also the cultural biologist for the Karuk tribe in California. He and Kari Norgaard published a really fascinating study on the emotional impacts of declining salmon in the Klamath River, which has resulted in the disruption of native identity and ways of life based on fishing. And their essay starts with a recognition that for Indigenous people in North America, land, plants, and animals are considered sacred relatives, and thus their loss becomes a source of grief. So what might come from recognizing and centering those emotions as part of the ongoing experience of colonialism and framing collective grief as its own index of environmental injustice? Reed writes, quote, "Because the dominant non-native society does not recognize the deep emotional ties we describe between humans and the natural world, Karuk grief and other emotions related to their loss is invisible. And that invisibility and lack of legitimacy compounds the harm done to Indigenous people." And this is what's referred to as disenfranchised grief, a loss that's experienced but can't be openly acknowledged or publicly mourned. Okay, so to recap these three productive aspects of grief, we have grief as a function of love and attachment, grief as a political act that challenges artificial divisions, and grief as a way to surface and understand less visible forms of structural injustice. So keeping this very extended context in mind, I want to now turn towards sharing a few key strategies for managing climate despair, as I promised I would. But I ask that we not lose sight of the value of grief and think critically about how it can actually boost our resilience rather than dragging us down. I really like this line from psychologist Mark Nepo. He said, "The pain was necessary to know the truth, but we don't have to keep the pain alive to keep the truth alive." Many of the strategies that I'll share are based on these resources, which I highly recommend to anybody wanting to learn more about this issue. All of these emphasize different affects. So Ashley Consolo up here is focusing on grief. Joanna Macy's work on active hope is very, very well known. Renee Lertzman, is looking at sadness and loss in her book, Environmental Melancholia. And also, the book is quite a bit about nostalgia, I think. She's a very well-known climate psychologist. Donna Orange is also a psychologist. And her work is actually looking at collective shame especially around environmental injustice and inequality. And she's kind of tracing that guilt around the climate crisis all the way back to legacies of slavery in North America and displacement of Native people. And then Sarah Jaquette Ray here, that book is going to be released in April, but she's a friend and colleague of mine, and I got my hands on an advanced copy, and a lot of her research is reflected in the tips I'm going to show you. So I hope I don't get in trouble with her publisher for leaking this. So these are the five tips I'd recommend. Number one is acknowledge it. And basically everything I just covered is a form of acknowledging our distress. If you're like me and you've spent entire nights lying awake imagining the end of the world, just hearing yourself say that out loud makes it more manageable. And many of you probably know this saying in neuroscience, if you can name it, you can tame it. And I think one of the reasons that this openness is especially important when it comes to anxiety and grief around climate issues is precisely because both the cause and the emotional impact remain pretty unacknowledged in public life. We barely even have a vocabulary to name the condition. So, of course, it's going to seem irrational or deviant. And there's also tremendous strength in that basic ability to stay present with our feelings. And I've heard many climate activists say that they feel intense pressure to always project hope and optimism. And I feel that in my classes as well. Of course, hope-based communication is strategically important. We all understand that. But I think the climate community can go too far in policing expressions of these darker emotions. And that can backfire when you consider that suppressing feelings of sadness and anger leads to much bigger problems down the road. That's where you start seeing chronic depression, substance abuse, rage. There's extensive research showing this. Khalil Gibran once wrote, "Many of us spend our whole lives running from feeling with a mistaken belief that you cannot bear the pain, but you have already borne the pain. What you have not done is feel that you are beyond the pain." Number two, talk about it. I already mentioned that hearing yourself talk out loud about dark feelings is therapeutic, but the benefits are social as well. One of the perennial questions in climate work is, why aren't more people taking action and demanding change? And our typical assumption is the public doesn't care or doesn't understand the science. But the research shows this is not true. National polling shows that almost 90% of Americans believe climate change is happening, and 62% identify as being concerned or very worried, according to the most recent surveys. This is coming out of the Yale Program on Climate Communication. But even though we're carrying this fear and concern around with us, we live in a culture of climate silence, at least here in the U.S. This is not true if you travel to most places abroad. But here, people don't talk about it, and that makes it seem less urgent or less likely that we'll see ourselves as the ones with agency and responsibility. And instead, we assume, okay, well, scientists or politicians will deal with it. So I've included an example here from climate communication analyst George Marshall. I think this says it all. This is after years of testing this. He wrote, quote, "I am consistently dropping climate change into conversations with strangers, talking about the weird weather or something similar. I'm always casual about it, but however I say it, the result is always the same. The words sink and die in midair, and the conversation suddenly changes course. This is hard to describe, but anyone who tries it knows exactly what I mean. It is like an invisible force field that you only discover when you barge right into it. Few people ever do, because without ever having been told, they have somehow learned that this topic is out of bounds." This is extremely dangerous, more than we could possibly expect, for the very simple reason that we are social creatures. Evidence-based psychology shows that having conversations and social interactions is the driving force of behavior change. Whether we're interacting at workplaces or schools or sports events or on social media, we look around and we take our cues from each other. And when climate change never comes up, it reinforces that socially constructed denial. Matthew Adams is a professor of psychology, and he's mapped out the pathways into different psychological states in response to climate change among the rubber ducky community. And luckily, this also applies to humans. It's a really complicated infographic, so I will simplify it just by highlighting a few spots. Here's where we start. We're confronted with the threats of climate change, and this has an emotional impact. So maybe you feel a little responsible, and then guilt and anxiety start to emerge. We feel threatened. We don't like it. That is completely normal. But left in isolation with those interior voices saying, I don't want to feel bad, that's where our unconscious defenses kick in. And that can lead to the realm of denial. And again, not so much the fact denial version, but the kind of everyday denial or repression that we all engage in because it makes it easier to get through the day and not change our lives. It's the same thing that we do thinking about our own death. Like, yes, technically we all know that we're going to die, but a lot of us don't believe it on some level, right? Because we need to function in daily life, right? So we have to get through our daily lives. You got to figure out what you're going to watch on Netflix. And so it's easier to kind of stay in this bubble of, again, it's not the fact denial version, but sort of a disavowal, you could say. So there's different examples of what these defenses can be. So minimizing our role, that's the yellow ducky, right? Thinking, okay, industrialization was inevitable, or we were born into a fossil fuel economy, it's not our fault. Minimizing the scale, the little blue ducky, I can just make small changes like switching my light bulbs. Another version of this is projection into the future, that little green guy, telling ourselves that the worst effects won't happen for another century. Or projection onto someone else, that gray ducky over here. It's the Republicans or it's countries with high birth rates. So what then would happen, what if something different happened when those unconscious defenses first kicked in? So let's rewind here. If we confronted our fear and grief and acknowledged this is hard, this is scary, and then in that moment, you got social support in the form of others saying, you know, me too, I'm upset, you're right, this is hard. You know, if a flotilla of rubber duckies came to support you in your darkest hour, you really would feel like you could cope and step forward to take action. Because a huge part of the depression and anxiety in response to environmental issues comes from feeling alone and isolated. When you feel isolated, you aren't empowered to take action. But talking about emotional responses helps create a sense of community and solidarity. And I previously had an entire slide with testimonials from my own students saying over and over that the single most helpful thing about taking my seminar was being in a room with others talking about the same struggles and being heard when they voice their distress. Catherine Hayhoe, probably many of you know her as one of the preeminent climate scientists in the U.S. She was asked what the number one thing we can do to address climate change, and I expected she's going to give some like wonky scientific solution for carbon reduction. She said, "Talk about it," because from there we're more empowered to make personal and political changes needed. This is what psychologists call sublimation, where you convert the energy that you were investing into defense mechanisms into more productive activities. And I'm going to talk more about the personal versus political in just a minute. But again, social reinforcement is crucial to maintaining those commitments. So if you're consuming less or have made other changes, share that with others, which opens up the space for them to share or at least offers an opportunity to encounter social or alternative social cues. In terms of political engagement, this down here. Connecting with others reinforces our understanding that climate issues require collective action. I know this raises the issue of how do you talk to people who don't believe in climate change or who oppose aggressive action. I'm going to skip that for the sake of time, but I'm happy to come back to that in the Q&A. The real takeaway here, though, is we have to get rid of this binary thinking about talk versus action. And it's everywhere in the climate community that we don't have time for talk, or we need less talk, more action. This is very misleading. Talk is action. Number three, get outside or make time for other forms of self-care. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with the research showing that time spent outdoors enhances mental health and well-being. People who have remained successful in environmental activism over the long term draw strength from their connection to nature. But most activists are notoriously bad at giving themselves breaks. We feel like we have to attend every meeting or every volunteer event or protest, or we feel guilty when we don't and we make up excuses. But self-care is exactly the kind of work that enables us to be social change agents and helps us avoid burnout so that we can stay engaged over the long haul. We have to remember that the climate battle is a marathon and not a sprint. I love Audre Lorde's line. She says, caring for myself is not a self-indulgence. It is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare. But most importantly, being in nature reminds us why it's worth fighting for climate solutions in the first place. The world is still a beautiful place, and there is still so much left to protect. And Rachel Carson once said, the more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and realities of the universe about us, the less taste we shall have for destruction. Number four, we're almost there. I only have five. Channel your grief creatively. So in my classes, this usually involves creative writing or readings in literature and poetry, which humanize the problem. So it's not just an abstraction that we represent with charts and graphs. And that helps us connect the issue to our own lived experiences. Chris Jordan has said that art is the kingdom of feeling. It offers a way to transform something painful into something beautiful. Ritual is another powerful way of creatively navigating the mourning process because it provides structure in the midst of turbulence and creates a path for us to continue with our lives after a loss. And since it's already familiar to most of us as a response to personal bereavement, ritual can be translated to losses in the natural world. A lot of my students initially wince at this idea, like the idea of a memorial service for a bird or a glacier just seems really foolish. But ultimately, they recognize that that response is itself the symptom of a culture that doesn't offer us meaningful ways to acknowledge non-human lives or lost places. So my students will actually incorporate humor into those ceremonial aspects. They've staged memorial services for coral reefs or written eulogies. So the responses don't always have to be serious and somber. Some of them have taken inspiration from the performative elements of Extinction Rebellion, like the hearse pictured here. There are also global events like the Remembrance Day for Lost Species, which is every year on November 30th. Anyone can host an event. Here you see mourners carrying a replica of the world's last passenger pigeon to be burned on a funeral pyre. This is a processional for the Great Auk, which was driven to extinction in 1844. And more recently, this was just this past summer, Icelanders held a memorial service and installed a plaque commemorating the first glacier lost to climate change. Here's another piece, again, depicting the passenger pigeon, which incorporates some ecological performance as the tide rises over the sand to erase their forms. Practices like this are cathartic, so they allow intense feelings a safe release through ritual. But grieving in a collective fashion also removes isolation from other mourners, which again helps shake us from mass denial. And then finally, I already noted that public expressions of grief can have political impacts since they bring visibility to losses or injustices that would otherwise go unacknowledged. And then the final tip is to take action. Action is the best antidote to grief. There is nothing more therapeutic. It's action that gives rise to hope and not the other way around. Of course, this always gives rise to the question, what type of action is most effective? what's the best thing I can do? There really is no single response to that, which feels both daunting and liberating, I think. One thing that makes the climate crisis unique is that it is truly all-encompassing. What's happening up in the atmosphere is only a symptom of something much more complex brewing down below. So it's not just about CO2 emissions, but our economy and our consumer way of life, who we elect. It's about agriculture and food. It's the books that we read our children, our buildings and cities. It's about education. It's about arts and humanity and culture, right? The stories that we tell and the values we communicate. It's about human rights and social justice and racial justice. In the climate battle, the front lines are everywhere. That's both a challenge and an opportunity because it means there are endless ways that you can engage. You don't have to wait for a protest in the streets. The advice I give my students is use the tools you have. For me, that's been the humanities. I'm not a climate scientist or an expert on environmental policy, but I don't have to be, and you don't either. We really need to redefine leadership in this moment. Every person alive will be impacted and is a protagonist in this story, so all of us can contribute. I think the best approach to determining how you might get engaged is to prioritize two things. So identify what you're good at, so you'll be effective, and then what aligns with your passions and your interests so you don't lose motivation. And luckily, those two things usually overlap. So that could mean anything from arts or social media to making changes in your workplace or your school, could be working with kids, planting community gardens or being involved in other service projects. I've mentored video game designers right here at the Pacific Science Center who are developing games with climate themes. People can work in the realms of law or public health. Taking action can also mean listening with compassion to someone with whom you disagree, or linking up environmental issues to social justice movements and efforts to address inequality. Dar Jamail and Barbara Cecil wrote, "Each one of us must choose the path that is ours. The sum total of this is legions of people taking action in their unique ways." If anyone does want to geek out on the relative impact of different interventions, Project Drawdown is an amazing resource. But just don't get too hung up on, you know, which act will absolutely maximize your impact unless you're really passionate about refrigerants, apparently. I think you should just do what gives you pleasure and remember this adage, right, that ecosystems thrive on diversity and symbiosis. So does the movement to preserve them. And I want to be clear here. The point is not that 12 people doing wetland restoration up in Bothell on the weekend are going to solve climate change. What matters, I think, is getting engaged exercises our civic muscles. And that is imperative at a moment when we desperately need collective action. For too long, we have been fixated on individual consumer responsibility and market solutions. So buying eco-friendly products, eating less meat, carrying your reusable bag to the store. Those are great, they're important, but they pale in comparison to what we can achieve through coordinated political action. This is a systemic threat, so it requires organization at every level. Communities, states, nations, and international agreements to coordinate among them. We do not have 50 years to solve this by gradual consumer change. David Wallace Wells wrote an op-ed last year reminding readers, quote, "The effect of individual lifestyle choices are ultimately trivial compared with what politics can achieve." So buying an electric car is a drop in the bucket compared with drastically raising fuel efficiency standards for all vehicles. Flying less would be way easier if there were more high-speed rail. More people are making a personal pledge not to have children, but promoting global gender equity is one of the single most impactful ways of reducing emissions. And that's been shown through extensive research and calculations in Project Drawdown. It's one of their top recommendations, demanding equal education for girls and women, equal pay and professional opportunity, and scaling up voluntary family planning efforts, including access to contraception and reproductive health resources for every woman who wants it. Those kinds of efforts advance basic human rights for women and slow population growth dramatically. So the point of all those examples is there's no comparison in relative impact between structural changes and individual lifestyle changes. This is what's meant when we refer to politics as a moral multiplier. So politically, this makes sense, but it also makes sense psychologically. And this is going to be my final point. Getting engaged in climate solutions helps build solidarity. I already mentioned that the sense of isolation is what makes people feel hopeless and depressed in the face of this existential threat. So cognitive psychologists emphasize how important it is to imagine ourselves as part of a team. Sarah Jaquette Ray has even said, not feeling alone is probably the most important prescription for long-term resilience in climate work. Imagining yourself as part of a mass movement also counteracts that pervasive and very understandable concern that our actions are too insignificant to matter, right? Why even bother? And my students hit this wall all the time. They feel helpless and demoralized because their impact is dwarfed by the scale of the crisis, especially when they start to understand the complexity of climate issues, that it's inextricably linked to capitalism and our broken democratic institutions and inequality and the entire global energy infrastructure. Like, where do you even start? But if we see ourselves as working collectively rather than individually, we can recognize that all contributions sync up with a larger network of change. This is what Adrian Marie Brown calls emergent strategy, a movement that spirals out from all kinds of small local actions. The entire premise of her scholarship is that small actions and connections create complex systems. And the economist Donatello Meadows expands on this by reminding us to think about leverage points, which she defines as places within a complex system, whether it's a corporation, an economy, a living body, a city, an ecosystem, where a small shift in one thing can produce big changes in everything. And there's an example of this I love from Rebecca Solnit's book, Hope in the Dark. It's great medicine to anybody who's feeling overwhelmed. I highly recommend it. Women's Strike for Peace was the first organized anti-nuclear movement in the U.S. And when interviewed, the participants said they felt that their efforts achieved nothing at the time. But in fact, they ultimately contributed to major victories like the 1963 ban on above-ground nuclear testing, which was creating the radioactive fallout showing up in mother's milk and baby's teeth. And this slide shows an excerpt from an interview with one of those activists. So Solnit wrote, the woman from WSP told of how foolish and futile she had felt standing in the rain one morning protesting at the Kennedy White House. Years later, she heard Dr. Benjamin Spock, who had become one of the most high-profile activists on the issue, say that the turning point for him was spotting a small group of women standing in the rain protesting at the White House. If they were so passionately committed, he thought, he should give the issue more consideration himself. So this is a reminder that social change and our impacts are hard to measure. We pay attention to triumphant moments or highly visible figures like Greta Thunberg. But her global impact is the result of the invisible work of thousands and thousands of unnamed people behind the scenes who brought attention to the climate crisis in the first place. The scientists, activists, organizers, journalists, as well as teachers who ignited her awareness in school, and the youth climate strikers and other decentralized forces spreading this momentum and having unknown impacts of their own with consequences that may not be visible until years down the road or simply may be impossible to track. But this should be a reason for hope instead of despair, as Ray reminds us. Quote, our efforts are multiplied by a larger community that we may never have met, which emboldens us to keep doing the work and staves off the discouragement we may feel when we look around and see so much destructive behavior. So I'm going to bring my talk to a close with this quote from the Talmud and from Margaret Mead. This is a line I've always loved. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. Thank you.
Dr. Jennifer Atkinson presented this talk, Climate Depression, Confronting Eco-Anxiety in the Age of Crisis, on February 28th at Seattle's Pacific Science Center. The event was part of their Science in the City series. To find the full event and other great Seattle area talks, go to our website, kuow.org, and click on our podcast tab. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast, follow us on social media, and share your comments. We appreciate it. Thank you for listening. Tune in again soon.